And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Coming up in 1 hour, we've got Air Cascadia for you. It's headlines, it's interviews, and it's commentary with Chris Andre. Then at 10:15, Flashpoints will be off today. Instead, we'll hear Law and Disorder, featuring an interview with Ajamu Baraka, longtime activist and veteran of the Black Liberation Movement. We'll also hear from Eleanor Stein, a judge and environmental lawyer specializing in climate change, and Alex Geert-Kastemans, professor of private law in the Netherlands. They talk about how courts are requiring governments to take adequate actions to limit greenhouse gas emissions. At 11 today on Between the Covers, the guest is Jeff Kohler, author of Darjeeling, The History of the World's Greatest Tea. And at 11:30, the film show visits Oregon's drive-in theaters. Tune in and find out where to bring your roadster, your bike, or even your two legs to a screening under the stars. But first, we've got an hour-long press watch up next with the news you're not supposed to know. Teresa Mitchell is coming up on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the summer concert in Dawson Park, featuring a live performance by Bamba Isupilon Dasukar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. The mission of summer concerts in the park is to bring cultural diversity to metropolitan area residents. Bamba Isupilon Dasukar Band play a full range of popular and traditional salsa, son cubano, timba, and tropical styles as cumbia, merengue, y bachata. Again, that's the summer concert in Dawson Park with Bamba Isupilon Dasukar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. Dawson Park is located at North Stanton and North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information about ticket prices and directions can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. The problem with doing things as a herd is that one can become accustomed to daily acts of violence to the degree that it becomes seemingly traitorous to question that violence. In our U.S. society, we have been conditioned to accept the idea that we should be daily monitored and occasionally violently attacked in order to maintain the social hierarchy, a hierarchy of predation, deprivation, and for the few, excessive consumption. A friend of mine once said to me, "Imperialism begins at home," and I thought the truth of that statement fairly evident. In our family units, we tend towards divorce, and in that divorce paradigm, we tend to saddle the women with child rearing as if it were somehow her natural duty to take the fall in work status and pay while the men start new families or not. Here in the U.S., we fail to even remember that it takes men and women to make families, and we allocate very little to women to raise our children, as if the kids were evidence of immorality rather than evidence of the continuity of our own existence. Here's a quote from a USA Today story that ran 2 days ago. About 22% of children in the U.S. lived below the poverty line in 2013, compared with 18% in 2008. That's according to a foundation, that counted it all up in their Kids Count Data book. In 2013, the U.S. Department of Human and Health Services official poverty line was $23,600 and change for a family with two adults and two children, which is not enough money to get by on, but the report examined data from several agencies ranging from 2008 to 2013 to assess state-by-state trends of 16 factors of children's well-being, including economics, education, health, and family and community, and it found that 1 in 4 children lived in low-income households in 2013. 1 in 4 children. Low-income families are defined as those who use more than 30% of their pre-tax income for housing. So, 1 in 4 kids live in low-income situations. That's violence directed at the most vulnerable. And it's an indication of the utter collapse and failure of capitalism. Capitalism, not to be confused with mere economic activity, capitalism, the rule of those who have the most capital, allows the greediest and most arrogant to take as much as they can, more than they could under a more rational paradigm, and it maintains that maldistribution. Even as our kids, you know, I can say our kids, right, because I'm a U.S. citizen, I live in this society, and whose kids are these? Do they belong to the Germans? Do they belong to the Danes, to the Japanese? No, these are our kids, and they do without the things they need, even to the point that, as we all know, children are often consigned to sleep in the back seats of cars. How American is that? This is not just capitalism, but patriarchy at work, because that statistic of 1 in every 4 kids living in poverty represents a large number of single women desperately trying to provide after their men have left for greener pastures. But then the workplace and the society double down on those women and children, denying the human right to housing and dignity, refusing to support our own children with a minimum income, forcing women to choose between the consequences of leaving a competitive workforce or watching their children die of neglect, deprivation, and malnutrition. And by the way, in the civilized countries, they provide a minimum income for children because they're not monsters. So what are we? At least 7 in 10 mothers, according to the Pew Research Center, with children younger than 18, were in the workforce in 2012, and yet 1 in every 4 kids is living in poverty. We accept this violence as necessary and normal. Why? But that's not because it is necessary and normal. It's because we are collectively insane. It's what we get used to doing as a group. The nature of our insanity is a devotion to violence as a way of life. And it extends far beyond our desperate children. We target each other for violence as well. This week, there are more rumblings from the political right seeking to make Muslims into second-class citizens, as if the recent violence in Chattanooga took place outside a roaring tempest of gun violence. Quoting Bloomberg News, while motor vehicle deaths dropped 22% from 2005 to 2010, gun fatalities are rising again after a low point in 2000, according to Atlanta-based Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Shooting deaths in 2015 will probably rise to almost 33,000, and those related to autos will decline to about 32,000, based on the 10-year average trend. Putting aside for a moment the unbelievable madness of a transportation system that kills 32,000 people per year, we're supposed to become alarmed at a few deaths of U.S. servicemen due to a rage attack from a Muslim gunman. Are those 33,000 gun deaths due to a massive insurgency of Muslim attackers? Of course they are not. They are, for the most part, Christians, as we see by the sincere imprecations to God during the funerals. But the newsreels bring the isolated attack on the U.S. Armed Forces Recruitment Center to the fore of the attention. Hour after hour, day after day, as if Islamic faith represented some great threat and crisis. Oh no! Oh my God! Here come the Islamic people! Again, the score is Christians 33,000, cars 32,000, and one berserk Muslim 5. So, this business of whether the society needs to be changed to back off the Muslim insurgency is mere hate mongering, and we've become very, very accustomed to it. And you would think that we would know, as Americans, what happens when a society decides to point to a whole category of people and say, these people are evil and you should be scared of them. The former general, Wesley Clark, had some comments on that. I'll be bringing that up in just a moment. But likewise, we extend our violence to each other for being black or brown. The rise of video sharing has proven, if anyone needed proof, that there is an ongoing genocidal war within the borders of the U.S., a civil war against black people, with our beloved police forces acting as point soldiers. If we saw this level of violence being directed against an oppressed population in any other nation, we'd be calling for coalition-led airstrikes to put an end to any hateful regime that would act in such a way. If we saw some other nation denying people jobs and dignity the way we deny jobs and dignity to black people, we would call for measures, but we look the other way. We look the other way as we assign Wackenhut G-Force to round up Spanish-speaking indigenous-descended immigrants taken in creepy, steel-clad, blacked-out buses right here in Portland to the intersection of Southwest Bancroft and Southwest McAdam Streets. There it is, a privately held secret dungeon that no one may access. You may reliably expect that none of the hundreds of illegal visa-scoffing Canadians that live in this town are in that dungeon. But we don't know what's in that dungeon because you can't get in there. McAdam and Bancroft. No, and here's the other side of that violence, which I haven't even finished outlining. The other side is that there is another population of people, actually also a minority, that benefits from this system of violence. That would be me. The population that is not followed around by suspicious police is not expected to make meals for their children or even to know where they are, that isn't expected to work twice as hard for half the pay, that isn't suspect just for the religion they grew up with. Okay, it's the former me, and that would be the white male U.S. citizen, an arbitrary category of descendants of Europe, less than 25% of the population, and the designated winners of this system of pain and deprivation. Sure, they're well represented in the prisons as well, but they have to work harder to get in there, don't they? They can cruise around town with a busted taillight all day, all year, for the rest of their lives and never be searched and scarcely ever even be stopped. But I'm not here to rail against white men. I'm here to point out that white supremacy is a handy tool for the maintenance of the unjust, disastrous, world-destroying rule of the billionaires. Through white supremacy, we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. It's insane to let billionaires rule us, and it's inevitable that billionaires will. It's insane to let anyone accumulate the wealth of entire nations unto themselves. It's got nothing to do with democracy. We should ban billionaires, and it's an easy enough thing to do with a tax over some bloated sum, 10 million, say, in accumulated wealth. Sure, let people be rich. Prosperity is a wonderful thing, but billionaires do not represent prosperity, but rather bloated inequity. The existence of billionaires is proof of the utter failure of capitalism. No human being works so well or so brilliantly as to deserve to arrogate thousands and millions as times as much wealth as a median worker. There is no such thing as a person that superior, and yet we see, as for example with the odious Donald Trump, that it is monomania and deranged arrogance that is being rewarded with these unbelievable and degenerate sums. Trump does not see himself as a bloated tick, of course, but rather believes that he is the acme of achievement, and the deluded masses turn to him for enlightenment. All of this would be bad enough if it were limited to the borders of one benighted nation, but it is not. Of course it's not. There's too much violence in America to be contained by mere seas. So it is that we, the victims of this system of extremist hierarchy, threaten the entire planet with violence. Hundreds of bases overseas, armies, navies, drones, a whole fleet of world-destroying atomic weapons. Those same children who occupy the back seats of cars at night are grist for the mill. They can lift themselves up by their bootstraps and levitate on over to the recruiting centers to learn how to shoot and spy and bomb and control drones against all the world's population that is too poor to afford effective anti-aircraft missile systems, and that's most of the world. We are told to worship these soldiers as heroic sacrificers for freedom, whose freedom it is unclear, and then to ignore them as annoying, dangerous debris when they return home with their hearts poisoned and their limbs blasted off. This violence, this is the United States of unjust violence, extends even to the farm animals we eat, who will not even allow, or not even allowed, the momentary dignity of a walk in the barnyard, who live their entire lives in cages so small they cannot move. The violence now extends to the biosphere itself, which has warmed to the point that Greenland is melting down and the satellites have to be pushed upward to avoid the drag of the swollen atmosphere. It extends to our own bellies where we ingest the radioactivity that has been forced on the fish in the Pacific Ocean. We are the United States of violence. Feel the hate. I suggest we turn against the life-destroying madness. I call for a general strike, a day of peace and celebration against billionaire rule, against imperialism, against factory farms, against the Jim Crow drug war and the incarceration state, against the unbelievable and unstated paradigm that would have us destroy the entire planet for the sake of the convenience and comfort of the billionaire ruling class. It would be a day, or maybe it would be a week, of peace and celebration for us, because that's what a society should be for. A society shouldn't be for the comfort and convenience of the billionaire class or for any hierarchy. A society should be for everyone, and it should be for the planet. We don't have to participate in our own destruction and misery. We could refuse, we workers, and what would the outnumbered rich do? I have some news headlines, and we have an hour today, I do believe, and you can call in if you like. The number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Wesley Clark is in the news. And I turned to World Socialist website, WSWS.org, for their article, Wesley Clark's Internment Proposal, The Specter of Military Dictatorship. And if I have time, I want to talk about the specter that's over Portland and the West Coast right now, not just the earthquake, but the shock doctrine that would surely follow if we do not defend ourselves. And before I say anything else about it, I'll repeat what I've said for years. If there's a quake in Portland, do all the things you need to do, but at some point, come down here, even if it's just a pile of rubble. Even if it falls on me right now, be glad to be a part of it. Take one of my leg bones and use it for a mic stand. I don't care. I just want to be a part of it. But we will need to organize. Oh, yes, we will. Not just for distribution of everything from bandages to water, but to protect ourselves. There's a major, major quake. Come down to KBOO. Right out here in the street, we'll meet. But Wesley Clark made statements. The retired four-star general and former NATO commander talked to MSNBC News last Friday in support of placing radicalized and disloyal Americans in World War II-style internment camps. And they write, it must be taken as an urgent warning by the working class. They write, Clark, America's most prominent political general, was speaking not just for himself, but for powerful layers within the U.S. military intelligence apparatus and ruling oligarchy who fear the growth of social opposition and are preparing to defend their interests no matter what the cost. The event that prompted Clark's televised remarks was the recent killing of four Marines and one sailor in an armed forces recruitment center in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Clark's proposal for mass internment was advanced as a response to the so-called self-radicalized lone wolf phenomenon, labels that have been applied to a handful of terrorist incidents over a course of more than a decade. The vast majority of such lone wolf incidents have involved hapless and, in some cases, mentally disturbed individuals who were set up by the FBI and police agent provocateurs. Remember Mohammed, speaking for myself, and the Turkey bomber, who would have set off a bomb, except that he didn't know how to make a bomb, so the FBI made him a bomb, and he wasn't radicalized enough to make a bomb, so the FBI radicalized him, and then they brought out the whole thing and the fake bomb and said he would have pressed the button and sent him down. But that it wasn't just about ruining his life. It was about scaring the crap out of you. Be very afraid. Official message from the FBI. But returning to the article in WSWS.org, if Clark's proposal were implemented, such sting operations and subsequent frame-up trials could be dispensed with, as the self-radicalized were identified by their thoughts, statements, or internet postings, and summarily thrown into concentration camps. Keep you safe. Gotta remember, be afraid. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and James is on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
So, about that guy who killed the Marines, you know, I I'm sorry to hear that they got killed, but I think the point that I think two things that people are missing here. Number one is that they don't realize that the people who are suffering in the Middle East are suffering because of our drone bombings. They don't have any way to retaliate against a nameless, faceless bomber. You know, they can't, they don't have any sort of way to defend themselves. So, you know, of course they're going to, you know, somebody's going to get upset. They got family over there, so somebody's going to reach out and do something. And people are seeing this like it exists in a vacuum and that people hate America. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, they don't look at what we're doing over there. And I think that's a huge thing, because if people really understood the type of warfare that we were really engaged in over there, you know, they would probably, I would hope they would think a little bit more critically about an attack like this that happened on American soil.
There's reasons to be angry, certainly.
Yes.
I think people have been made angry just so that we can have enemies to some extent. I mean, that's not the be-all and end-all of U.S. imperialism, certainly. It's just a little part of it, but it helps keep us afraid if we think that maybe if we let down our guard, people will come swarming over here screaming and take everything we have.
Yeah, well, you know, and two, you know, it's like, well, not on the same point. We're all the enemies we're fighting over there, our government trained.
Funny that.
Like, you know, so it's like, I mean, it just, you know, people don't think critically enough about it. The other point that I wanted to make, a Muslim goes into an army recruitment center, obviously is very upset with America, kills four servicemen, he's a terrorist. But Dylan Roof goes into a church that is historically known for its resistance against white supremacy, kills nine very prominent people in the community, and he's a disturbed individual.
Yeah. How's that work? Excited.
Yeah. I am beyond words that they, you know, they tried everything that in them tried to hide the word terrorist.
Well, and I also want to say that we can't really, when I say we, in this case, I mean white people and white liberals will never move effectively against the government until we find an effective and honorable way to be in solidarity with black self-defense movements and with black revolutionary movements. And we need to be able to take their leadership in certain categories. We need to understand that that is an essential part of the destruction of American social fabric, and that these people are our brothers and sisters.
Oh, most definitely. History has definitely shown that the government doesn't really care about uprisings again in the communities of people of color, but it's only when people of color start uniting, start bringing messages that unite both white folks and people of color. That's the only reasons why, you know, people like to fantasize that, you know, Martin Luther King was killed because he was for the freedom of blacks. But no, it's like because he was for the freedom of everyone. And it was a message that everybody was picking up on, and they saw that, and, you know, they squashed him out. Same thing with Malcolm X. So, anyway, no, I appreciate the topic this morning. Thank you for bringing it up.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I've been trying to kind of throw a crack into the propaganda mindset that allows us to go along with the violence that we experience day to day, that allows us to go along with a society that is against the society, a society that works against our lives and against life on Earth. First, we have to see it. Then we have to decide what to do about it. And actually, we absolutely can decide to do something about it, and things can move quickly when we do, when we all decide that we're not going to be part of this planet-destroying, soul-destroying madness that we call corporate capitalism. 503-231-8187, and Heidi's on the air.
Hey, Teresa.
Hi.
As always, I appreciate you bringing up really thoughtful subjects and talking about it at an angle that people just don't want to talk about. Like, you keep talking about Fukushima, which I keep telling people, that hasn't gone away. So I think I've only heard you talking about that. So I appreciate you always putting these subjects on the table.
Well, I hear that word on KABU. I just want to put in a plug for KABU. You can hear about Fukushima on other programs on KABU,
yeah,
especially the news, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, and the way that you tie it into other subjects, though, I think is really important. The reason why I'm calling is because I'm part of a new collective in town called the Maryland Buck Abolitionist Collective. We sprung out of work that we were doing with the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Many people know Ajamu Umi, who started that chapter.
Well, I like that word, abolition.
Because we're for prison abolition and so many other things. So this Sunday, this ties in perfectly what you're talking about. This coming Sunday at an Other Words bookstore from 5 to 7, Ajamu is going to be doing a workshop titled American Identity Equals White Supremacy. And it, I mean, people don't want to think about it that way, but that's in fact, you know, what keeps getting perpetuated. So we're a really radical collective that's trying to use the white European settler privilege that we have to talk to other people who are like us. Because quite honestly, and this is what a lot of people of African descent and other folks and Palestinian folks that I organize with, it's not their responsibility to teach us about the privilege we have. It's our responsibility, those of us that are conscious about these issues and understand the way white supremacy works, to talk to other people who benefit from that same privilege. And until people like myself and other folks start doing that in large number, I don't think there's going to be much change. You know, people of African descent, indigenous people, they have a hard enough time trying to organize themselves and trying to figure out how to survive in this white supremacist culture. So we need to start to organize ourselves and reach out to other people.
Right on. There's so much to be said about it.
Like one, I'm sorry?
I said there's so much to be said about it. I was just thinking about one tangential aspect of it, which is I, for example, am a mostly Irish American. Where are your people from?
I have Norwegian, Danish, German heritage.
All right.
And what's interesting, too, is I was talking to my partner about this, who's of African descent, and I was, you know, we're getting ready to have this reunion, and I can trace back my family back to the early 1600s to Norway. We have pictures that my ancestors brought over from Norway, Denmark, all these places. And then it occurred to me that the person that I spend my life with is not afforded the same privilege because of slavery. They know their parents came from Louisiana, but that's about as far as it goes because of what, like, there's so many levels of oppression that have happened. And we take so much for granted that we're like, well, I know where I came from, you know, and nobody really wants to talk about the issues. But I think that, you know, we have a lot of work to do. And I think that having a really radical kind of discussion that's going to happen this coming Sunday is probably a good starting point.
Right on. So give the details for that again.
It's an Other Words bookstore this coming Sunday, which is the 26th, from 5 to 7. Again, it's a workshop conducted by Ajamu Umi. If a lot of folks in Portland know that he puts on really good events.
Is that downtown still, in Other Words?
In Other Words bookstore, yeah. I believe it's on Killingsworth is the address that it's on.
Okay.
And again, the title of the workshop is American Identity Equals White Supremacy. And what people have to realize is it's not just the Confederate flag that's a problem. If you look at the origins of the American flag, so we like to parcel out all of these issues. And yet, if we're not, if those of us that benefit from white supremacist culture because we have white European settler privilege don't challenge that, then we're perpetuating it. And we need to start to understand that, you know, we have to stand up against it. It's you know, there's a lot of work to do, but we have to start somewhere. So I think this work that we're going to be doing and engaging in Portland is going to be really important. And secondly, we're not going to be like the typical white liberal privileged people who sit around and talk about socialism. We're going to be actually in affiliation with the AAPRP, the All African People's Revolutionary Party. If we're going to talk about indigenous issues, because we're still on stolen land, we're going to relate to and talk to and ask for input from the indigenous people. Like, we're really trying to do this work in a really respectful way. And it's a really great collective because we have trans folks there, we have queer folks there, we have a lot of people that are trying really hard to find, because Portland, let's be honest, it's a very white, liberal, male-dominated town. I've been a part of the socialist movement in Portland for about 4 years. And as a white female, you know, I have to deal with sexism, but I also see the way that white males constantly interrupt and take up way too much space and aren't even, you know, they want to talk about socialism and racism, but they're not even dealing with the fact that they have all this privilege.
You're making some really great points. And
yeah.
I should leave room for other callers. So
yeah, I don't want to take up too much time, but like this is an important, and I just want to appreciate you on air one more time because you do such great work. So thank you so much.
Right on. Thanks so much. Okay. Time is 9:29 almost in Portland, Oregon. This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Press Watch. And I'm Teresa Mitchell, and I've been talking about the violence of American society and how deeply rooted that is in white supremacy. And indeed it is. I mean, if you look at that American flag, that's the flag of Dred Scott. That's the flag of three-fifths. It's all there, and ignoring that or saying that that's not a big deal would ignore the economic basis of the nation and the social fabric of the hierarchy and the oppression that made this nation what it is and continues to make this nation what it is, unfortunately. The topic of Fukushima was brought up. Let me give you that number again, 503-231-8187. There is an interview, speaking of Fukushima, with an experienced sailor and fisherman on E&E News. And his name is Ivan McFadden, and he was on Talk Radio Europe. He was talking about sailing with sails in the Pacific Ocean. He said, the reality was if I would have had no spare dry food on the board, relying on fish this time around, we would have starved to death because quite literally there aren't any fish. There are vast tracts where they're all just gone, where you could fish reliably. They're just not there. He says, I used to fish here on the exact same course, exactly the same time of year, in the same ocean, on the same course, in the same place. Could catch fish every day, and for some reason, now 10 years later, they're all gone. He has attributed his statement, the ocean is broken, to the impact of Fukushima. And speaking for myself, global warming is having a tremendous effect on the ocean food chain as well. But the host of Talk Radio Europe asked him, what about seabirds and all of that? And McFadden said, as you get up closer to Japan, they're all gone. They're not there anymore. Everything's all gone. It's like sailing in a Dead Sea. There's nothing. And he asked, after Japan, you headed to America. Did you see any impact from Fukushima? And he responded, it's dead. That's where I coined the phrase, the ocean's broken, because for thousands of miles, there's nothing. No birds, no fish, no sharks, no dolphins, turtles. They're not there. All those beautiful creatures, they're all just gone. We'd seen a whale around about 1,000 miles off Japan, just lying on the surface with a big tumor just behind its head. It looked like it was going to die. It didn't try to get away. It didn't flap its tail. Didn't do anything. It had such a profound effect on me, he said. Just talking about it makes me feel like I want to cry. So that's on E&E News. From same source, salmon fishermen off the Washington coast are coming up with algae-coated nets. Green goo, they call it. And they are not coming up with salmon. So the number to call, 503-231-8187, and George is on the air. Hello, George.
Hello.
Hi.
I suffer a little bit from depression, and now I am really depressed from what you were talking about. These are problems that society has created that are monumental, and I'm a guy that always wants to fix things. And what I'm calling about doesn't have anything to do with what you're talking about, which is important. But I was reading The Oregonian the other day, and Joseph Rose, who is the automobile transportation columnist, wrote an article about people who stand in the on-ramps to freeways with signs begging for money. In some cities, they are police people who are catching people without seat belts and on their cell phones. My biggest complaint is the cell phones, because I have seen talked to quite a few people who have been injured.
I thought you were going to bring that around to a tangential comment on poverty. What's your point with that? You're right, it is off topic, so I'm going to give it short shrift to tell you the truth.
They're having police people dress up as beggars.
Okay, well, that has to do with violence, and that is tangentially topical, so I appreciate you bringing that up.
But my concern was the... maybe I'm interrupting into a conversation that's not acceptable at this time. I don't know. The guy that I talked to before you said I could talk about anything I wanted to.
We don't pre-screen callers. I do ask that you more or less stick to the topic. That's interesting information, so I do thank you for calling in. Number to call is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I was talking about the quake. A lot of people are talking about the quake since there was an article in the New Yorker about it. It was a good read, and it was a scary read. I'm concerned that the impending quake in the Northwest means a shock doctrine that would apply to Portland for the convenience of rich white developers. And I think this because I remember Katrina, and perhaps you do as well. So I have an article by Bill Quigley in Alternet that I want to bring up. But first I want to talk to Paul. Number to call 503-231-8187, and Paul's on the air.
Hi. I was going to mention something about this corporate rule problem, but since you're talking about the quake, I have something to say as well. I just recently ran into something called, geoengineering, having to do with a lot of secret military programs going around where they're literally, spraying stuff in the air like they have been for decades and kind of lying about what they're doing, but it's having a lot of effects. They're finding aluminum in just about everything.
Even when you say they, who's finding it?
Excuse me?
You say they are finding aluminum. Who is?
I don't know. I saw a thing with a gentleman from geoengineerwatch.org, and he's got some links on there where I guess they're finding aluminum everywhere. And I just wanted to throw that out there because you don't hear about this much anymore. You hear about a lot of problems with corporate greed and all that kind of stuff, and I understand that's those guys are scumbags, you know, but as far as the climate change problems we're having in the world these days, we all as individuals all over the world have a responsibility. We should drive less. We should do a lot of things that are better for the environment. But overall, I encourage you and your listeners to check out geoengineering because this seems like it's more than half the problem in the world. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Thanks, Teresa.
Thank you very much. 503-231-8187 is the number to call, 503-231-8187. When Hurricane Katrina, pardon me, hit the Gulf Coast on August 29th, 2005, the nation saw tens of thousands of people left behind in New Orleans 10 years later. It looks like the same people in New Orleans have been left behind again. This is an article that is on Alternet. It's from Bill Quigley, a human rights lawyer and professor at Loyola University in New Orleans College of Law. And he writes, the population of New Orleans is noticeably smaller and noticeably whiter. While tens of billions poured into Louisiana, the impact on poor and working people in New Orleans has been minimal. Many of the elderly and the poor, especially poor families with children, never made it back to New Orleans. The poverty rate for children who did make it back remains at a disturbingly high pre-Katrina levels, especially for Black children. Rents are high and taking a higher percentage of people's income. The pre-Katrina school system fired all its teachers and professionals and turned itself into a charter experiment capital of the U.S. even while the number of children in public schools has dropped dramatically. Since Katrina, white incomes, which were over twice that of blacks, have risen three times as much as blacks. While not all numbers are bad, they do illustrate who has been left behind in the 10 years since Katrina. And then he has a list of statistics, some of which I would like to share with you. The number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Rent in New Orleans is up 33% for one-bedroom apartments and 41% for two-bedroom apartments since Katrina hit. This is very tough because in New Orleans, 55% of residents rent. And I'm bringing this up. This should be known. And there's a lot of people who came here from the New Orleans diaspora after Katrina and then the Katrina Jim Crow hit. I am concerned at how we will be treated post-quake, not just by FEMA Region 10, but by the capitalists who are, predators by nature. And who used the shock doctrine, that's a book by Naomi Klein, who used the shock doctrine to expand their profits at the expense of those who have suffered disasters. This is something we can expect, and so I say again, major quake, meet at KABU. But Lance is on the air. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Hi, Lance. What's up?
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the inequities that you were talking about a little bit ago, about how billionaires are coming up with so much money, how people are becoming so rich and so many becoming so poor. What I found out is that maybe we should go back to the system we had in the 60s, that when the corporations reached a certain height of amount of money that they had to branch off and build another business, which made it so that people had an equity, and then more people would be able to be put to work, and they could make more money on that in that manner, in that era. And that was really comfortable at that time when I was a little kid. My dad made a small amount of money, but it was big back then. We owned a home, we had a house, we had a lot of things to play with. So that's what I wanted to tell you. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, that's a great thing to say. And I just want to say that the reason that you hear that people in, let's say, Denmark have greater social mobility and greater wealth. People in Japan have greater wealth than you do. People in France, people in Germany. Why is this? Why did people have more wealth in the late 50s, early 60s than you do now? And the reason, the primary reason, is conscious distribution of wealth to some degree.
Yeah.
Conscious distribution of wealth is very much present in the Scandinavian countries. And the question that they are dealing with is how will they distribute their wealth? And in the United States, that is verboten even to talk about. And that is why Occupy was so important, is because it cracked the door to class analysis. People just didn't ever want to go there. Saying the word capitalism got Ross Perot in trouble on a debate, I remember way back when. I mean, you just didn't say it. You weren't supposed to mention the system. There's a good reason for that. It's an exploitative, extractive system that pits us all against each other.
Let me tell you something. That is the only time I ever voted was when Ross Perot ran.
Giant sucking sound.
And then they threatened his
I'm all ears.
And you never hear from him again.
Yeah. Well, I could talk about Ross Perot, but I shan't. But funny to bring him up.
I'll look him up on the internet and see how he's doing. But he's doing pretty good still.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. 503-231-8187. Yeah, there's a conscious distribution of wealth in Belgium, in Denmark. These are the civilized countries, and their society is primarily, although it is certainly subject to capitalist parasitism, their society is viewed as primarily for the society as opposed to for the rich, which is what we have here, and that's why we're not supposed to talk about it. We're not supposed to talk about capitalism, not supposed to talk about distribution of wealth. We're supposed to believe that an open-ended, parasitic distribution of wealth to the billionaires is supposed to be good for all of you. Why, that leaves it open for you to become a billionaire. Ha! You will never be a billionaire. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Joyce is on the air.
Hi. Hey, I have a question for you.
All right.
At the beginning of the program, I was in traffic coming home, and you mentioned a building on Bancroft and McAdam. Could you explain that to me again? I live in the neighborhood. I don't live down there where all those rich people live. I live right above that. And somebody had said that there's a building down there with a lot of security around, and this must be the same one. So what are they doing down
there? Barbed wire, cameras.
Yes.
Guard. Yes, that is a prison. I've been calling it a dungeon because I know how G-Force runs those facilities. It is for this region of the immigration and naturalization. Let's see, the ICE. It's a different acronym now, and I keep forgetting what it stands for.
Okay.
But they grab, as I said, they grab brown people who don't have documents, and they go into that prison, and it is... It is a prison, okay. And as for the, you know, what it's like in there, we can only go with descriptions from other prisons at this time, from people who have been in them and who have gotten out for one reason or another. But people are being held in there. Usually, we're talking about an abject place where the temperature is kept very low, and there is absolute control, in short, a dungeon.
Oh, really? You know, this is ironic because this neighborhood traditionally was where immigrants settled, my grandparents. This whole area, you know, was all immigrants until the early 50s. And what I'm going to do is simply let, you know, my neighbors and my friends know, because there's been mystique and we knew that something horrible was happening. And that's all. That I don't want to take any of your time, but I truly appreciate what you're doing, and I thank you so much.
Thanks for calling. Sure. I come from Irish stock. They didn't pop up here
And there were also a lot of African Americans and Asians in this area. And also, you know, part of our neighborhood was destroyed by the urban renewal gentrification back in the late 50s. We lost 7 synagogues. We lost just a lot of beautiful housing and wonderful small businesses, and it was destroyed. And so, anyway, just wanted to add that, but I appreciate what you're doing, and thank you very, very much.
Thanks for your call and your comments. Your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. It's 9:44 Pacific time here in Portland. This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and Susanna is on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I want to make two comments, one about the earthquake article. I have a house on the coast and in Astoria, and they really have been pressing being prepared in a way that I don't think Portland so much has. But if you look at Chile in the last, like, 8.9 earthquake, I think 5-6 years ago, they did really well. If you are retrofitted, your houses and buildings are retrofitted, you're ready. They had very little loss of life, really not much building damage.
Well, that's just the thing. They had one. They had a major quake like that, a major rip, subduction zone rip in the 60s, and they are far more prepared than Portland is. Portland has unreinforced masonry all over the place, especially in Old Town. That's all coming down, every brick of it.
And then the one thing about the shock doctrine, I think that after the housing crash, the U.S. money people have been applying it to the housing market. I have rentals, and I watch the rental markets, and you, as a big bank, you can buy up all the depressed houses much easier than individuals.
Oh, heck yeah.
And then have the big management companies managing them.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing about having plenty of money. Is like you can afford to spend what it to you is a small percentage of your income and sit on it for 20 years until the price goes back up. So, yeah, they want to snap it
up.
Well,
no, what they're doing is turning it all into rental properties. And to rent, you have to have impeccable credit, income, et cetera, just to rent. And so I find people more and more, if you are at all marginalized, and then they have the rents absolutely maxing out, and so they have much more income than their mortgage payments, and it's the investment strategy for big investment funds, too, is to do this rental thing. And I find the rental market more and more is in this kind of strategy and managed by the management companies.
What would we do with our money if we ended rents and mortgages?
Yeah, I think homelessness is going to increase faster and faster because of this also.
I think you're right. But I just want to ask you, supposing we ended rents and mortgages and decided to take on some other system of distributing housing and viewed housing as a human right, what would that look like just in terms of people's income? What would they do with it? How much do you pay for rents or mortgages?
Well, because I'm on the end of owning, I know that you can get more for rent than you're paying out in mortgage. But to me, my ideal fantasy for when the world crashed, the new world, what I call the new world order crashes, is all these many, many properties of the wealthy. They're in beautiful places. They have tons of bathrooms and bedrooms for entertaining. They all should be cooperatives, and everybody takes over all. You know, they have tons of houses, one wealthy couple. And they're in beautiful places. And wouldn't that be lovely that everybody could share them?
Yeah, and we don't have to be Dr. Zhivago about it. Everybody can still have a place. Hey, thanks very much for your call.
You're welcome.
Number to call, 503-231-8187. I'm very glad to be hearing female voices, and I meant to call for that specifically. It's just a thing about, I mean, I have not altered my voice for radio particularly. And I live as a woman. I'm transgender. And my name's Teresa, and so when I'm out doing my job in public, you're more likely to hear me talking something like this, which is not a very good female voice, but I try to raise it a bit. And but for some reason, in front of the mic, I just have to use the full baritone, and I think that baritone invites male callers, which is fine. I'm glad to hear from male callers, but it's really good to hear from female callers for a change, and I think KBOO, you know, that's part of our charter, is to serve the underserved. We're making a joke. We can say, serve the undeserved. We try to avoid that. How does it go? Afflict the comfortable, comfort the afflicted. Number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. I was talking about the situation in New Orleans 10 years after Katrina and that shock doctrine. And I was talking about it in terms of this information that we have that a truly devastating earthquake is on its way. And I believe, if I remember correctly, and they were, these figures were credibly backed up, that there's, I can't remember that. Sometime in the next 10 years, we have a really good chance of a full Juan de Fuca plate Cascadia subduction zone rip happening, an 8 or 9 point quake smashing everything. And so we must prepare. Each of us has to prepare to some degree. I think that the government certainly needs to prepare, and probably more than they're doing. I applaud the efforts to strengthen the bridges, etc. But there's a great deal more to be done. I think that a ferry should be designated and made available so that, that will help us get across the river. I think that logistics should be considered for getting distribution of water and medical aid and et cetera when that quake finally hits. I think that needs to be an open discussion and something that's figured out beforehand, because when it hits is not the time to be figuring out detailed logistics. So I can only hope that FEMA Region 10 is up to speed on that. I'll try to find out more about that in the coming days. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I mean, one thing you can do certainly is to have a first aid kit and some of those gallon jugs of water. You can get those for a buck if you know where to look for them. But I was talking about the statistics of Louisiana. In 2005, 38% of the children in New Orleans lived in poverty, 17% percentage points higher than the U.S. as a whole. The most recent numbers show that that's gone up to 39% post-Katrina. 10 years after, I mean, the thing with Katrina, it was so shocking, is that first the hurricane hit and then capitalism hit. First the hurricane hit and then the Jim Crow shock doctrine hit, and the effects were shocking. I'm going to have to make a call out to the engineer, an unusual situation. I need to duck out just for a moment, and if you can run a bit of music, and I'll be right back. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Okay, I am back. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and I was talking about the shock doctrine as it was applied to New Orleans and the way that it worsened the whole situation there. One thing that I recall when I look at the statistics post-Katrina for New Orleans is a comparable situation when was it 1906 or 1908? Maybe the engineer remembers the great San Francisco earthquake hit. Within a couple of days, a train on a repaired track had charged into San Francisco with tons and tons and tons of supplies. Now compare that with the unbelievably lame response of the U.S. government when the hurricane hit New Orleans, when Katrina hit 10 years ago. New Orleans has 44 school boards, but prior to Katrina, nearly all the public schools in New Orleans were overseen by the New Orleans Parish School Board. 91% of the public schools in New Orleans are now charter schools. Only 32% of African Americans believe the new charter school system is better. 50% of the black children in New Orleans live in poor households, a higher percentage than before Katrina hit. New Orleans is now 59% African American, down from 66.7%. So when you hear that Katrina turned New Orleans white, we have the numbers. Down from 66.7% to 59%. Prior to Katrina, New Orleans incarcerated more of its citizens than any city in the U.S., five times the national average. Ongoing efforts by community members and local officials have reduced the number of people held in jail by 67%. So that's the only good statistic I can come up with. And as I was saying, this is from an article an article from Bill Quigley, human rights lawyer and professor at Loyola University in New Orleans. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And this is the sort of thing that I think we should guard against. And that might mean literal guarding after a quake. That's why I say we should gather here outside KBOO after a major quake. Of course, the station won't be running at that time, but there'll be lots of diodes and capacitors and potentiometers and microphones in the rubble, and we'll just have to fish them out. And I think that I can almost guarantee that KBOO will be one of the first stations back on the air, because we have discussed this extensively, and we have a mission here. We're not just employees. This is KBOO Community Radio. And so, yeah, we will get the frequency up and running one way or another if we have to run it up on an aerostat balloon, whatever it takes. There are 9,000 fewer families receiving food stamps in New Orleans. 7,500 public school teachers and paraprofessionals were fired when Louisiana took over the New Orleans public school system after Katrina. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear their appeal. The median income for white families in New Orleans is $60,000. That's $35,000 more than for black families, whose median income was $25,000. In the last 10 years, the median income for black families grew by 7%, but for white families grew three times as fast by 22%. So I'm giving you these figures so you can see through various angles how this sort of thing is done and what we can expect when the Great Northwest quake hits. The New Orleans metro area has 44,000 more Hispanic residents in 2013 than 2000. Total is now just over 8% of metro population. 71,000 fewer people live in New Orleans than before the storm. That's a major impact. People just having to leave. And I imagine that people will have to leave, especially right away after the quake here. There are 99,000 fewer African Americans living in New Orleans now than in 2000. Compared to 11,000 fewer whites. $71 billion was received by the state of Louisiana for Katrina repairs, rehabilitation, and rebuilding. It's not clear who got the money. And Quigley made an index that makes it clear that you can sort of tack your way to who did not get the money. So you've been listening to Press Watch. One more news item. And we'll go to Air Cascadia at the top of the hour. Whole Foods, which has a $13 billion in growing annual revenue, sells overpriced fish, milk, and gourmet cheeses cultivated by inmates in U.S. prisons. This is according to alternet.org. The renowned green capitalist organic supermarket chain pays what are effectively indentured servants in the Colorado prison system a mere $1.50 an hour to farm organic tilapia. So when you buy those little fish at Whole Foods, you're supporting $1.50 an hour. And by the way, speaking for myself, this is just another example of how profitable white supremacy is. Colorado prisons, they already grow 1.2 million pounds of tilapia a year, and government officials and their corporate companions are chomping at the bit to expand production. But that's not all. Whole Foods also buys an artisanal cheese and milk cultivated by prisoners. The prison corporation Colorado Correctional Industries has created what Fortune magazine describes as a burgeoning $65 million business that employs 2,000 convicts at 17 facilities. The base pay of these prison workers is 60 cents per day. Whole Foods purchases cheeses from these prisons, which literally pay prison laborers mere pennies an hour, and subsequently marks up the price drastically, a whole paycheck. So you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. We've been going out to you via the terrestrial transmitters at 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area, other frequencies elsewhere in the Northwest, and via the World Wide Web to all the ships at sea.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO, your community radio station, KBOO Portland. We're about 15 minutes away from, no, not Flashpoints. It's off today. Instead, we're going to hear a special edition of Law and Disorder featuring an interview with Ajamu Baraka, longtime activist and veteran of the Black Liberation Movement. We'll also hear from Eleanor Stein, a judge and environmental lawyer specializing in climate change, and Alex Geert Castermans, professor of private law in the Netherlands. They talk about how courts are requiring governments to take adequate actions to limit greenhouse gas emissions. At 11 today on Between the Covers, the guest is Jeff Kohler, author of Darjeeling, The History of the World's Greatest Tea. And then at 11:30, it's the film show. Today, visiting Oregon's drive-in theaters. Tune in and find out where to bring your roadster, your bike, or even your two legs to a screening under the stars. But first, it's Air Cascadia up next with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Hey, thanks KBOO members for your generous support. Not a KBOO member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., with an after-party on Clinton Street from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. The community parade, Metamorphosis, will start at 10:45 a.m. There will also be artisan, craft, and community booths, sidewalk sales, live music, food, and more. Again, that's the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 to 5 p.m., with an after-party on Clinton Street going until 9 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.